This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Okay, Buzzkillers, it's me, it's the professor. We're here busting myths and taking names. We're here with the final, and I should say crowning author of the wonderful new book from Oxford University Press, The Churchill Myths, Professor Stephen Fielding from the University of Nottingham, who's one of the three authors of this new book, which of course is on the Buzzkill bookshelf, and I think is one of the most important books to talk about Churchill this century. Professor, we talk about Churchill all the time on the show because the myths are so big and they're so important and they're so enduring. There's so much in your chapters in this book, and there's so much in the book in general. But really, I thought what was so fascinating, what I think our listeners would like to hear, especially our American listeners, is the Churchill on screen, Churchill in the movies, Churchill in the films, Churchill on television. And a lot of your chapter is taken up with that. And it seems to me what's so interesting about it for our purposes is what you call eventually a confusion of Churchills. There are so many different Churchills presented, it's hard for people to know. But anyway, that's a long way of saying thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
So how does Churchill start being depicted in film?
Well, he starts, first of all, Churchill was interested in in representation in general. Right. I mean, he was connected in his interwar years when he was comparatively poor. The film mogul Corder employed him to write scripts. I'm not sure if that was really just to give him an excuse to give him money. But yeah. So Churchill was kind of involved on the periphery of the filmmaking industry. He wrote a novel as well in his early days. So he was interested in fiction making and drama. But the first depiction of Churchill was in a Hollywood film, Mission to Moscow of 1942, which itself has got a very interesting history, because it's one of the few examples of a pro-Soviet Hollywood film, where we get a lovely depiction of Stalin as a cuddly uncle, and it actually gives a version of the Stalinist show trials, which takes Stalin's side. So it's a very interesting wartime film, and Churchill is depicted by a minor Hollywood actor. Who's got the requisite build, because you've got to have the build.
Churchill,
and a vague approximation of the voice, because the film's about based on the memoirs of the American ambassador to Moscow in the kind of late 1930s, early 1940s, and it's a really fascinating film in its own right because of the wartime kind of nature of the film. It gives a very pro Soviet view, Stalinist view of the communist regime, and even takes Stalin's perspective in the show trials of the 1930s. But Churchill appears, played by a minor Hollywood actor who's got the necessary build and he can do approximation of the voice, the accent, as the appeaser, the anti-appeaser that he is. I mean, he's a kind of prophet in the wilderness,
right,
of the 1930s. I mean, by that time, of course, Churchill is prime minister. He's been vindicated. And all of that. So this is how Churchill is going to be reproduced in many of these films and dramas. You know, the prophet in the wilderness who warned against the Nazis and then saved Britain from itself almost in the summer of 1940. So the first approximation is thanks to Hollywood, and that's also significant because many of the versions that we see on the big screen could not have been put on the screen and the small screen had it not been for American money and the promise of an American audience. The Churchill that we see on the screen is an Americanized Churchill. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a version that many Americans had learnt to see of Churchill. It's not necessarily the only version that British viewers would have of Churchill,
right,
but it's certainly and I would say it's also the dominant version of Churchill.
Right. So that's the first one, although he's obviously not a major character in that.
No.
But But the other thing I find interesting is that in the 50s and in a lot of the early 60s, there are these films where he's, you know, you see him or you hear his voice, but it's only obliquely, you know, he's not a major character. He's sort of in the background. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of those going all the way up to the Battle of Britain. Do you know why, for instance, all these films seem to want to have him in the background, but definitely have him there?
Yes. Yeah. Well, there was an inhibition on the part of the British to depict current leaders. Mm-hmm. There was a certain, you know, a fear of lèse-majesté, and certainly for Churchill, that was definitely the case, that you couldn't really depict a political leader, certainly of the stature of Churchill, directly face-to-face. And there were lots of problems with the voice as well, and people didn't want to sort of have a hammy Churchill. There was a paranoia about having Churchill depicted in the right way. So, and the BBC itself, the national broadcaster at that time, had an actual ban on any representation of Churchill, which they policed somewhat irregularly. But for the most part, they managed to stop any kind of depiction of Churchill, primarily because they didn't want anything to be critical of him.
Mm-hmm.
So these films, these wartime films produced in the 50s into the 60s, like you say, they wanted Churchill in it, but they kind of had a spectral Churchill, a Churchill in the shadows, or a Churchill you could hear but not see, a Churchill that you could see the cigar. You kind of represent these basic representations of Churchill and saying Churchillian things, saying the things that you would expect, you know, the cliches of Churchillian rhetoric, and playing a central godlike role, but then disappearing as the mortals then went and did their stuff in, you know, defeating the Germans.
Yeah, so, and I think the godlike role is perhaps most evident in the Battle of Britain, where the only scene he's in, he's sitting above on a sort of a balcony in a war room, map room situation, watching the planning of air defense and saying nothing, but he almost is Olympian sitting up there.
And the film itself ends with his, you know, first of the few, and so it ends with these words. And the interesting thing about that is, I mean, that came out in 1969, so he's already dead by now. And there are plans. I mean, this is the interesting thing. One of the bits that I write about, and the thing I found utterly fascinating as well as really quite comic, is that the plans to make a film about Churchill were finally coming into fruition, a proper biography, a biopic of Churchill, which became known as Young Winston. And that was released in 1972, but it had started in 1956. I mean, Dore Sherry of MGM had wrote to the Churchill people and said, look, you know, I'm head of production at MGM. I'm a great admirer of Winston Churchill. We would like to use his book, My Early Life, as a kind of young, you know, we want to look at the man that became the hero.
Right.
But that was in 1956, and part of what I write about is the very tortuous journey that is revealed getting young Winston in 1972 finally on the screen. And that reveals a lot about the myth-making and the attempts to sort of mould the Churchill image in different ways between Hollywood and the Churchill people.
So, you say in the chapter, and perhaps the most interesting thing is this build-up, this long build-up to filming this thing called The Young Winston, directed by Richard Attenborough, who in his long career was into the 21st century and what Americans at least will know him as in Jurassic Park. So he's been around, he has an almost Churchillian lifespan. But this is one of his early movies as a director, as a producer, as a major mind behind a film. How did that all come about?
Well, it came about. I mean, this kind of reinforces my kind of point that the image that we have of Churchill is to a large extent an American creation. It starts with a letter that Dore Sherry, who was head of MGM in 1956, he sends a letter to the Churchill people. By this time, Churchill is kind of enjoying life. He's no longer prime minister. He's kind of not particularly, you know, engaged in many things apart from just living and making money as well. He's very interested in making money. So Sherry writes a letter. I mean, Sherry's a Democrat, but he's a Cold War liberal. He's, you know, he's bought into the idea of Churchill saving Britain and saving the world, as many others have. And he writes a letter saying, I'd love to make this a film about, you know, Winston Churchill's early life. And we'd like to base it on his book about his adventures as a young man in the Boer War, in the Sudan, you know, before he became even politically, you know, an MP or whatever. And the Churchill people, I mean, all of this is in the Churchill archives, in the papers of somebody called Jack Levine, who's another American producer. He's responsible for all kinds of early images of dramatizations and documentaries about Churchill. And he kind of elicits a response, which is very snooty at first. But basically, Hollywood wants to make a film about Winston Churchill. The Winston Churchill people are very interested in the money, but they want to make sure that Churchill's reputation, his image, is retained. You know, they want to control everything about it. So basically their line is, okay, so if you want to put the novel as written onto the screen, great, you know, you can do that. But we want to have a veto over the director, the scriptwriter, who's going to play Sir Winston and all of that. And those are impossible kind of conditions, many of them, for Hollywood, because Hollywood wants to make a film for Americans. They want to make a film about Winston, Sir Winston, that Americans are going to find, you know, of interest and be able to identify with Churchill. And Churchill as a young man is not a particularly identifiable character. It's not a rags to riches story. That you can tell. I mean, he's born into the aristocracy. He's got a privileged life. You know, it's hard to make that into a story of rags to riches. So the Hollywood producers, they come up with, we must make up an enemy for Sir Winston to overcome. It's always popping up and trying to stop him getting, you know, doing stuff. They want to make things up. They want to dramatize it. And the church people say, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. So there's a to-ing and a fro-ing between Hollywood and certain company. MGM loses interest. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And then eventually, Carl Foreman, this is by the early 1960s, who is an American, is sort of son of a Jewish immigrant, but is also blacklisted and has to work it under the McCarthyite kind of stuff that's going on in the 50s.
Yeah.
Carl Foreman, who also is he's a liberal, you know, he likes Sir Winston as a man who saved the world from Nazism. He takes it up. And in the end, it's Foreman that makes young Winston as producer, and Sir Richard Attenborough, who is a Labour supporter. He's a man of the left, but also sees Churchill in these heroic terms. They kind of make this film of Churchill's early life, which is essentially like young Mr. Lincoln, like Ford's Mr. Lincoln. It's an origin story. It's saying these are the characteristics that Sir Winston showed as a young man, and these are the characteristics which allowed him to save Britain. So it's still all about 1940 and the war, but it's about how did this man come to be this figure that helped Britain save itself.
And it does depict wars. It's not Sir Winston at school. It's not Winston as a young man at school, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's definitely him as a soldier,
as an imperialist soldier. Yeah, fighting the Boer War, the last cavalry charge against the last British large cavalry charge in Sudan, and it doesn't really question any of those kind of values at all. I mean, as Foreman said, you know, this is the version that Sir Winston would have wanted to be put out. So it doesn't question anything. In fact, and it comes out in 1972, and I watched it a few times, and there's even a scene where British soldiers are in the Sudan and they're burning a village. They're burning a village, right? And I'm just thinking, God, in 1972, this is what American soldiers were doing in Vietnam.
And yet
there's no criticism at all. This is just what you do when you're an imperialist. You know, that's fine.
Yeah. We should tell Buzzkillers that we're going to put a link to where you can find this on various streaming services, Netflix and that sort of thing. Although it's not as commonly available as I thought it was. You sometimes have to wait to find it, or sometimes, you know, buy it through iTunes or whatever. But what happens in the rest of the 20th century, if you will? We'll talk about 20th century films after the break. But between young Winston and the end of the 20th century, we see him depicted a few times, but we're not overwhelmed with Churchill movies.
Well, we get him on TV a bit, but you can't have, they're kind of coming waves, because you can have a surfeit of Churchill's, I think. But you have a Churchill depiction which then defines how people see Churchill for a kind of a generation. And then after a few years, there's a need for another actor, another production, another perspective. Although many of the perspectives are quite the same. So the first time we get a television dramatization is in 1974 when Richard Burke, and that's the centenary of Churchill's birth. So 1974, it's a terrible year in Britain. The strikes, there's 3-day weeks, the country is reduced to darkness. It's not a great time at the Britain. But 1974 is also the time of the centenary of Churchill, so lots of celebrations about it. And so the BBC, in association with this American producer, Jack Levine, and American Money, put on for the first time a full TV drama representation of Churchill, played by Richard Burton. And like virtually every single sort of dramatization of Churchill that we see subsequently, it's about the 1930s, his vindication over appeasement, and then he comes to save the country from itself. He becomes prime minister. His destiny, as he sees it, and is represented as being, you know, a true thing, his destiny is fulfilled. And so that reinforces the idea that Churchill, the man, saved the country.
Right.
That the country didn't save itself. It was through this great leadership of Churchill that happened. The irony of this is that Richard Burton, who is obviously one of the greatest actors of his generation, and had actually provided Churchillian voices for certain documentaries and certain occasions, read Churchill's readings. I mean, so as people knew, he was a very, you know, pro-Churchill kind of a guy, comes from South Wales, and the mining valleys of South Wales. And Churchill is not a very popular figure amongst the miners of South Wales.
No.
Because of his perhaps slightly, some myths cut one way or another. The myth of Churchill in South Wales is that before the First World War, as Home Secretary, he sends in the troops to break a strike and, you know, people are killed. The myth is exaggerates what really happened, and we're not quite sure what, you know, Churchill really didn't quite do that, but that's what he's known for. Yeah, and even in the general strike of 1926 in Britain, Churchill is an implacable opponent of the miners who go on strike. I mean, that's definitely on record. So for Richard Burton, Churchill is the man who saved Britain. I mean, he thinks that's what happened, but he's also the man that kind of really didn't like the working class. And so he actually describes that he has a love-hate relationship. And just before the drama comes out, he writes an article for the New York Times in which he says, "I hate Churchill. He's a coward. He's a toy soldier." You know, I mean, at this time, Burton was, you know, he was on the bottle quite a lot. But I think it did express his genuine views, but maybe in a slightly more vivid way than maybe it might have done had he been literally sober. I don't know. But that shows you, at least in terms of Britain, that there's Churchill the hero, the man that saved Britain, but also Churchill, the man that hated the working class, you know, the elite, right-wing ideologue.
Well, Professor, this is a good time for us to take a little sponsorship break. And when we get back, I'd love to talk about the sort of explosion of Churchill-based films or Churchill-featured films in the 21st century. So Buzzkillers will be back in a moment. As you might well guess, Buzzkillers, this episode is being sponsored by The Great Courses Plus. If you want to understand these Churchill myths we're talking about, of course, you need to understand the general biography of Churchill and the biography of what he did and the history of how these things developed in the 20th century. The Great Courses Plus has the perfect course for you to watch and listen to about this subject. It's called How Winston Churchill Changed the World by Professor Michael Sheldon. It goes through not only Churchill's whole career, but all the contextual background and all of the major events. Remember, Churchill lives for almost forever. He lives from 1874 until 1965. It's a very, very important analysis of what happens during that time and his place in each of those events. Now, that's one of the reasons I love The Great Courses Plus. They have excellent professors who teach you exactly what you need to know. And you, of course, can have a free trial because you're a buzzkiller. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill to start your free trial. There's so much to learn and discover. Classics like history, literature, and science, and even hobbies and activities like chess, which I'm terrible at, and all sorts of things you wouldn't ordinarily expect in a courses program like this. They're all there. Their streaming service offers engaging lectures about anything and everything, and you can watch it on all of your devices, your television, your computer, your iPad, your phone, whatever, whatever, whatever. And it's the perfect time to sign up for the Great Courses Plus. That's because, as I said, my listeners get free access to their entire library. That's right, free. Don't wait any longer. Sign up today using my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. And now back to more Churchill. Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers, with Professor Stephen Fielding from the University of Nottingham in Northern England, who's one of the co-authors of the fantastic new book, The Churchill Myths, just out from Oxford University Press. And we should remind the Buzzkillers that those of you who are members of our Patreon group, Patreon supporters, those who are members of Buzzkill Society, can email in and we'll put your name in a hat and draw out the winner of a complimentary copy of this book. So kindly provided by Oxford University Press. So please do that if you're a Patreon member. And if you're not a Patreon member, go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and find out how to become one. Professor, we talked before the break about, if you will, the films between the end of the war and the end of the 20th century. But there have been so many, relatively speaking, there have been a lot of 21st century Churchill films, and sort of culminating in the Darkest Hour, which a film which drove me nuts. But we can talk about that later. Why do you think that happens? I mean, is it just like, well, every 10 years we need to revive these things?
That 10, 15, 20 years. Yeah. I think that's kind of it. I mean, there's, you know, producer, you know, TV, I mean, it's HBO, BBC, there's a mixture between TV and the actual cinema, proper cinema, but there's money in them there, Churchillian Hills.
Oh, right? Yeah. There's
an audience out there. And, you know, they'll come to, whether they think of it in these overt terms or not, but there comes a point where they go, well, you know, when was the last time we had a Churchill? Maybe Timothy West, 1979. That was a while ago. People have forgotten about that. And maybe we can have more interesting perspectives, maybe. But certainly HBO, they're no fools. They brought out a pair of them in quick succession, albeit played by two different actors, probably because I think Albert Finney first played him,
right?
But probably got fed up of it, or he was a bit ill, so they had to get Brendan Gleeson to play him. And again, these cover the exact same period that they keep coming back to. It's the repetition that's really interesting about the Churchillian myth. I mean, in Britain, we see him from different perspectives, or different perspectives, but they're still the dominant myth,
right?
The dominant time of the man that warned against Hitler and the man that saved Britain from itself. And they keep coming back to that. And so the two HBO versions, the first one with Albert Finney, that was about appeasement, anti-appeasement. Mm-hmm. And the second one was actually very interesting because it actually started with Churchill waiting for the result of the 1945 general election.
Right, which he loses.
Which he infamously loses. But he doesn't know this, I mean, during the drama. Right. But essentially, it's him looking back to the war and how, you know, the moment that he saved Britain, you know, from giving in to Hitler, you know, and fighting on and all of that kind of stuff. But that's kind of interesting because it actually acknowledges 1945.
Mm.
And it kind of maybe gives us some clues as to why Churchill lost. But it was a kind of cake and eat it kind of drama because it was pandering to the myth while also opening out, you know, some suggestions about why maybe not everyone in Britain by 1945 wanted Churchill to be prime minister. But it fundamentally still underlined the Churchillian myth because it ends with him going, having lost the election, going to see, I think it's a Noel Coward play, and everybody in the audience applauds him as the man, you know, who saves the country. So there are some subtle changes in some of these dramatizations to accommodate what we, you know, a more pluralistic view of Churchill while still reinforcing centrally the big myth, because you don't get many friends, certainly in the United States, if you even slightly criticize the Churchill myth. I mean, the most recent cycle was, I think it was in 2017 when, was it The Darkest Hour came out?
2018.
Was it 2018?
2017 is Churchill.
Right. I think they come out roughly the same, within a year of each other. There's The Darkest Hour and the film Churchill.
Right.
And they take rather different perspectives on Churchill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I spoke to the scriptwriter, Alex von Tonselman, who's also a historian, who wrote Churchill. And that brings in things that we know about Churchill. You know, he suffered from depression and he drank a bit. You know, and what it didn't do was, you know, have a go at him. For, you know, it didn't say he was evil. It just said this is a man who had some issues. It didn't undermine the basic myth. It might have, but it put it into context. But right. She said the amount of grief that she got from people. I mean, Andrew Roberts led the charge, but a lot of them were kind of Churchill fans from the United States for even suggesting, you know, that he might have had some kind of depressive state occasionally. And of course, they didn't like the drinking references. So there are some people that can't take any kind of criticism. And I mean, the point was for the film Churchill, it was looking at him sympathetically, you know, saying despite these things. He was still this figure, you know, of consequence. But people didn't, you know, so people didn't quite like that. So it's safer to reinforce the myth. Go with the myth. Don't print the facts. Go with the legend. You know, to paraphrase, who shot Liberty Valance?
And The Darkest Hour goes with that myth in 2018.
Do you want me to talk about that, or do I have to talk about that film?
Well, we're going to leave this in because that's too good. Well, I have to say that when Lady Buzzkill and I went to see it in the theater, she was absolutely livid with me because I was jumping up and down every 5 seconds, say that didn't happen, that didn't happen, that didn't happen. But yes, give the Buzzkillers a sort of sense of what are some of the major problems with that film.
Well, I also went to see it in the cinema because by that point I was, you know, thinking about writing this book, or was writing this book, and I couldn't wait for the DVD. So, you know, there I saw it on the huge screen, which makes it worse. Anything that's terrible, it's always worse on the big screen. Anything that's good, it's always better on the big screen. And I couldn't quite, I mean, there were times when I was fit, well, I just wanted to leave. I mean, I just wanted to get out, and I thought, no, I can't. I have to remain a professional. And it was interesting insofar as if you compare how Gary Oldman played Churchill compared to how Richard Burton played Churchill in 1974, Churchill with Burton is very straight-faced, straight-laced. Emotions don't really kind of figure in anything. And that's not a real representation of Churchill. He was clearly a very emotional kind of a guy. So Gary Oldman gives us this kind of gargoyle Churchill, you know. He's he's all over the place emotionally. He shouts, he swears, he does the V signs, he does all kinds of stuff. So he's very, very human at one level, and therefore at some sense an approximation to Churchill. But then they throw in all this incredible stuff. I mean, they go off piste in terms of what actually happened because they want to turn something into a conspiracy to get rid of Churchill amongst these vampiric figures, you know, that, you know, Chamberlain and Halifax, they turn them into sort of melodramatic pantomime villains, which they weren't. So they kind of make things more black and white. And then, of course, they invent that infamous scene on the tube, which, you know, they admit they make it up. In which Churchill is, because for anyone who hasn't seen the film, Churchill is pondering, you know, should we do a deal with Churchill or should we not? I need to find out what the people think.
Should we do a deal with Hitler?
Do a deal with Hitler, yeah. So I need to find out what the people think. So what I'll do is I'll go down the tube to ask a random selection of people on the tube, what do they think, right? And, of course, Churchill apparently was only on the tube once and he got lost. He just went round and round and round. He didn't know you had to get off at any point.
And so, it was years before this.
Oh, and years before that, yeah. So he goes down the tube and he asks these people, you know, what do you think? You know, and so the people give him, you know, no, we need to fight on just as you want to do, Mr. Churchill. And then he starts to quote a poem and he kind of stumbles on the poem. And on the tube, there's a black guy who's clearly, you know, with a white woman, which is something he'd get beaten up, you know, in the 1940s, he'd get beaten up for doing that on the tube, very likely. And Churchill, who is probably a racist, you know, in the 1940s, he, you know, he thanks this guy. He touches him, which I strongly suspect the real Churchill wouldn't have done that.
No.
So they kind of mix up these Churchills to make him more sympathetic to a contemporary audience. I mean, that's what they're doing. And then he goes back and he says, "I have spoken to Shirley from Clapham or someone." And then, you know, she says, "We should fight on," so we should fight on. So it's horrible, schmaltzy stuff.
Right.
I mean, they're trying to make flesh, I think, the quote from Churchill where he says he was the voice of the lion. So that would be their excuse, I suppose. Right. But they do it in a way which is making a Churchill acceptable to a contemporary audience. And that goes back to young Winston and Hollywood's attempt to make Churchill acceptable to a Midwestern audience. The Churchill that we see on the screen isn't the real Churchill, but it's a Churchill made sympathetic to us. You know, there's a reason why mm-hmm. we might like Winston Churchill now. Mm-hmm. It's because he's been created to make himself likable to us now. So, you know, so nowadays, you know, he pops up in Doctor Who and he's Doctor Who. You know, most people listening know who Doctor Who is maybe, but, you know, he's Doctor Who's greatest friend.
Right.
But that's deliberate. It's not, it's constructed. It's to pander to our prejudices.
Right.
That we see this Winston Churchill before us at any one point in time.
Well, we couldn't have ended on a better note, because I think that's the sort of crowning significance and the crowning conclusion in this part of the book, is that he's created for this image is created for us to like him. And so it's not surprising that there is this kind of small C cult of Churchill, which several scholars have talked about. Well, it just remains for me to say thank you so much, Professor Fielding, for coming on the show to remind the Buzzkillers that the book is now out, right? It's in September, and they should go to the Buzzkill bookshelf and get it. And we hope that you'll be willing to come on the show to talk about your next research project when that gets further along.
Absolutely. After we've overcome the COVID crisis.
After we've overcome the COVID crisis.
Do research, yes.
Yeah, that's right. People don't realize, not exactly the most world-pressing problem, but historians have to stay home. They can't get in the archives. So thanks again. And
thank you for having me.
And we'll say to the Buzzkillers out there that we'll talk to all of you next week.